young folks back from camp and our Peru group back from their trip. And we want you to know that we miss you and we're glad you're back. We had you in our prayers while you were gone. And let's also remember to keep Tyrone in our prayers. He's still in Ethiopia and will be there for about another week. So let's keep him in our prayers until he gets home safely. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable. There was a man who had two sons. Thus begins one of the most beloved parables of all times. We usually call it the parable of the prodigal son. But in our introductory lesson last week, we shifted the spotlight from the son to the father and noted surprisingly that the idea of being prodigal is as applicable to the father as it is his younger son, because the word prodigal has nothing to do with lostness or waywardness, as we have sometimes assumed that it did. It means wastefully extravagant or recklessly spendthrift. And we noted that the father's welcome and acceptance to his penitent son when he came home was recklessly extravagant, in the sense that he didn't demand repayment from his son and he refused to count his sins against him. So we're calling these lessons, rather than the prodigal son, we're calling it the prodigal God. And this will be our second in this little series of lessons. And I'd like to make a note right here. In all fairness, the basis for these lessons comes from a little book by the same name that Josh Norgulens shared with me some months ago. And I appreciate him doing that. And I told him at that time I was so impressed with it that I was going to make a series of lessons from it. In our introductory lesson, we saw that the two sons represented two vastly different groups of people. The audience who was present, the tax collectors and the sinners, and then on the other hand, the Pharisees. And this audience represents two groups of people who are trying to gain God's approval through two vastly different avenues. And I want you to hang on to that thought through this series, because we sometimes just dismiss the Pharisees that they really weren't trying to make a connection to God, but in their way they were trying to. And it's a way that people, it's been around since the very beginning, is still around today, and in some cases very prominently. Jesus' story is a drama with two acts. The first act is the lost younger brother. The second act is the lost older brother. And so Act 1 has three scenes. And as the curtain rises, we see the younger son coming to his father. And just in a couple of very short verses, Jesus tells a lot. It's quite a shocking request that he makes. He comes to his father and he demands, "Give me my share of the estate." Now, in Hebrew society, if a man had two sons, then the older son received a double portion of the inheritance. And so, in the case of having two sons, the estate would have been divided into three parts, the older son getting two-thirds of it, the younger son getting a third of it. Now, to ask such a thing while the father is still alive is a sign of deep disrespect. It was then and it would be now. But it particularly was at that time. It would be the equivalent of saying, "I wish you were dead. I'm not interested in you, but I am interested in what I'm going to gain from you and the property that I'm going to inherit, and I want it now." And equally shocking to that request is the father's response. In this extremely patriarchal society in which respect for the elderly and particularly for parents was of supreme importance, it would have been expected that the next thing that would have happened was the father would say, "Son, get your stuff and get out of here. You're out of my will." That would have been what people would have expected a father to say under these circumstances, disowning him publicly. And to add to the intensity of this request, Jesus, in verse 12, whenever he came to his father and he said, "Give me my share of the estate," and then he says, He divided his property between them. He uses a completely different word than property. The word, the Greek word is bios, and we get things like biology from it. And the word means life, or it can be translated living. And so he divided his life between them. And he gave his younger son a part of his life. What he had worked for and what had been his goal in assimilating this property, at least a part of it. This father obviously had some other goals in his life. We can get that from his response. But this puts a deeper significance on the meaning of what this young man was asking of his father. It's very likely that the bulk of this man's wealth was either in land or animals. And in order to get one-third of the value of that estate, he very possibly may have had to sell land or animals to come up with that money. But he didn't even argue with his youngest son. He did whatever was necessary. He made whatever sacrifice was necessary to honor his son's request. There'll be a few of you in this audience who'll have some appreciation for what it would mean to have to sell some of your land. The Jewish people had and have a special attachment to their land. And we could all say amen if you read the news today. It is really a special thing, and it was at this time particularly because the land had been divided into the various tribes, and it was a very special thing to have land that your family had been given by God, and it fell your lot to have this. This land had been in the family for generations and generations and generations. The Jewish people had this special attachment to their land. Whenever my family lived in Oklahoma, every time we would come south and cross the Red River, and then on our return trip coming back, and we would cross the Red River, and there stands a big sign that says, "Welcome to Oklahoma." You know what my girls would all do? You know, don't you? They would all burst into this song, Rodgers and Hammerstein's song, "Oklahoma." And one of the lines says, "Oh, we know we belong to the land, and the land we belong to is grand." Kind of an interesting concept. You notice that it doesn't say that the land belongs to them, but rather they belong to the land. And this addresses the idea that people of the past, and still many families today, if you've kept up with the news, that happened to see the news yesterday morning, and it was talking about a family farm that is purported to be the oldest, the farm that has been within one family for 11 generations. Supposedly the oldest one, longest term farm still in the United States that the family had decided they were going to sell because none of the kids wanted to pick up the farming, and so they're going to sell that land. And it's kind of interesting that in the middle of all this going on, that made headline news on CNN yesterday. But this addresses the idea that people of the past and many families today still have their identities tied up in their place, their land. And to lose a part of your land was to lose a part of yourself. And it also would result in some ways in a diminished standing within the community. Because now what you have less part of it. Somebody else owns part of what you had in the community. And so this boy is asking his father to tear his life apart. And his father does it. The things a father will do and a mother will do for the love of a son. Our daughter. Jesus' audience would have never witnessed or imagined a family patriarch responding in such a manner. How do we normally respond when we feel that we have been or our love has been rejected? What do we normally do? We get angry, don't we? We even start retaliating. We criticize. We belittle the one who spurned our love, don't we? You know why we do that? We're trying to make it not hurt so much, aren't we? That's why we criticize and make out like that person's really of no real significance anyway. Because it hurts our pride. We're trying to diminish our affection for that person so that it won't hurt as much. But this father swallowed his pride. He ignored what he knew everybody in the community would say about him for doing such a thing. And he bears the embarrassment and the loss because he's my son. And it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. Love is not proud. It is not aroused to anger. It always protects. It always trusts. It always hopes. It always endures. Love never fails. The curtain falls. And when it rises again, Act 1, Scene 2, the plan. The outcome is predictable, perhaps even inevitable. The boy got everything that he asked for. His dream has come true. Now he goes and does whatever it is that he wants to do, and he ends up just exactly like everybody predicted he would. Broke and friendless. And you know what? It's hard to come home when you lived up to everybody's negative prophecy, isn't it? Enforced sobriety. One day, he wakes up in a pig pen. And he's got the mud and the smell of pigs all over him. And he remembers what it was like at home. His back is against the wall. He's out of options. There are no more friends. Their doors are closed to him. He has no more chips. He can't get back in the game. They've thrown him out and locked the door. And he's beat on the door to try to get back in. And nobody responds. His worst nightmare has come true. And so he makes a desperate plan. The only one that's left to him, unless he's going to take his own life. First, he'll return to his father and admit that he was wrong. And then he will admit that he has forfeited his right to be called his son. And secondly, he'll ask his father a favor. Make me like one of your hired men. And you need to understand what that involves. There were servants who worked on the estate. There, we see them as bit players here in just a moment. There were some employed servants there. But whenever there was a particularly dirty job, or whenever there was a job that required additional help, then day laborers were hired. They were, if you will allow it, the illegal immigrants. And they were hired from day to day. And they got paid at the end of each day, and they were called back tomorrow morning if they were needed. There was no job security. There was no guarantee of anything. And so the boy in the pig pen rehearses his plan over and over. And he finally gets his courage up to get up and go home. And all the way home, walking, all the way home, he rehearses over and over in his mind what he's going to say, how he's going to say it, how his father might respond. What's going to happen when he gets there? What's it going to look like whenever he gets home? Day and night, on his way home. He rehearses his story. He's thinking of the best case scenario and the worst case scenario. What's the best thing that could possibly happen? What's the worst thing that could happen when he talks to his father? And the curtain falls. And now scene 3, act 1. The boy's coming in sight of the old home place. And his heart is racing. He's terrified. The door opens. It's his father. And he's running. Middle Eastern patriarchs do not run. Children run. Boys and girls, young men run. Women might even occasionally run. But patriarchs, the dignified pillars of the community, the owners of the great estates, do not gather up their robes and bare their legs and run. But this father does. And when he reaches his son, he immediately grabs him and picks him up off the ground and hugs him and kisses him while all the servants are running out to see what all the ruckus is about. The boy's crying. His father is crying. He's trying to get his rehearsed speech out. And his father ignores him and interrupts him by telling the servants, "Quick, bring the best robe to put on him." Now, to whom would you suppose the best robe belongs? That would be his own. Whatever clothes he had on were filthy rags, and he was likely barefooted. And so his father says, get a ring and put it on his finger, and get sandals and put them on his feet. He said, "I'm covering your nakedness. I'm covering your filthiness. I'm covering your rags, your poverty, your shame, your disgrace with my acceptance and honor. Kill the fattened calf. We're going to call the neighbors in and celebrate." What a scene. Incredible scene. We've all envisioned it in our minds, and there's a startling message here. And sometimes what goes without saying needs to be said. It needs to be put in words. God's love and forgiveness can pardon and restore any and every kind of sin or wrongdoing, regardless of what you've done. The boy had disgraced himself and his family. It was unforgivable. He had ruined his life. He truly did not deserve to be called a son. And this seems to me to be a good place to roll out the verse, James 2:13, "Mercy triumphs over judgment." Do you understand what his father did for him? He gave him his life. He was dead. He was dead to the family. What had the boy done to deserve this kind of treatment? You know the answer. He hadn't even had a chance to clean up his life. He just had good intentions. He hadn't even recited his repentance speech. Do you understand that forgiveness is not deserved? Even acts of faith do nothing to merit forgiveness. Let that sink in deeply. Forgiveness is a gift. You can't do anything to earn it or deserve it. The father was being recklessly extravagant with this boy. He was the prodigal father. And the curtain falls. And this time there's intermission. You can go to the bathroom and get some popcorn. Now we're all back. Didn't take long. Act 2, the lost older brother. When the older brother hears from the servants, he's out in the field working. Let's say he's hauling hay, sweating. He gets close enough to the house that he hears something strange he's never heard in the middle of the day before. He hears what sounds like a party going on at the house without him. And so he climbs down off the tractor and he starts to the barn and the servants are there and he says, what's going on? And when they tell him what his father has done, that his younger brother has returned and his father has reinstated him into the family, he's furious. Now it's his turn to disgrace the father. He makes his absence speak as loudly as he possibly can. You ever known anybody to do that? You ever known any grown-up Christians to do that? He refuses to go in to what may have been the biggest feast and public event his father had ever hosted. And he forces his father to come out to him. But he's been offended. He's not going to make anybody's job easy. He's going to make everybody pay. You know what the worst thing is to somebody that can happen to somebody who's holding a grudge and they're mad about something that's happened? You can give them the opportunity to tell their story and nobody gets upset. That's the worst thing that can happen to them. They just think if everybody knew my side, if everybody could hear what happened to me and could see it through my eyes, then everybody would be as upset as I am. And so you get your chance. And if you don't get your chance, you make your chance. You go to your friends and you tell your story and you tell it over and over and over. And when nobody gets upset, you have a real choice to make in your life. Just like this older brother did. What does he want? In a word, he wants justice. Now, how much more noble can your request be? All I want is justice. He wants his brother to get what he deserves, which is less than nothing. And he wants to get what he perceives himself to deserve, which is everything. And his father is saying to him, I'm not going to disown your brother. He's my son. I love him. And you're my son. And I love you, and I'm begging you to swallow your pride and come in and join your family and your friends. And as Jesus is telling this story, his listeners are sitting on the edge of their seat. Will the family be reunited in unity and love? Will the brothers be reconciled? Will the older brother be softened by the father's plea? But the story ends right here. Why? Because the real older brothers are listening to the story. And they have a decision to make. And the story hasn't been completed yet. Will they stay angry and hostile and try to make themselves and everyone around them be miserable because Jesus is treating these sinners as well as he's treating them? Will they be angry, their pride hurt? Will they criticize and reject Jesus, or will they be happy that mercy triumphs over justice? Or will they continue to demand their pound of flesh? Will they rejoice in the Father's mercy? You see what Jesus is doing in this parable? He's redefining our connection to God. And for some of us, it needs to be redefined. Because the older brother, as hard as it is for them and us to understand it, he doesn't deserve to be called a son or be forgiven any more than his younger brother does. Well, that's the real message of this story. And that's why this story is hard. And that's why one group of people left this with tears of rejoicing and happiness in their eyes, and another left hostile and angry and bitter and determined to do something about this Jesus. The truth is, whether you're the older brother or the younger brother, acceptance into God's family is a gift. And you can't do anything to earn it or deserve it any more than anybody else can. Younger brothers, you've messed your life up. Can you believe this story? Can you believe how great God's love is? Older brothers, can you accept this story? Can you be happy with God's mercy and love and grace? You see, it's hard for everybody to accept God's grace. Some because they feel like they don't deserve it. Others because they feel like they don't need it. We're in desperate need of God's grace. And if you're here this morning and you're not a child of God, the Father stands with open arms. Whether you're a younger brother or an older brother, while we stand and sing.